That old cowboy went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky, and up the cloud he draw.
This is Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with Western Short Stories. During the fall of 2021, we read a number of short stories by Max Brand, the highly acclaimed early 1900s author of Western yarns, and other genres as well. We pretty much exhausted his production of one-hour-long tales, so I decided to tackle a longer story, which I will record over three programs. It is one of his first, and it is entitled Above the Law, originally published in 1918. I'll be reading it from The Collected Stories of Max Brand, Centennial Edition, edited by Robert and Jane Easton, which was published in 1994 by the University of Nebraska Press. But I'll begin with a short summary of the life of Max Brand and of his writings, adapted from the introduction to the book, which was penned by William Bloodworth. And I remind you that our stories are often edited for recording. This book is a collection of stories by the writer who, from 1917 to his death in 1944, published popular fiction under the pseudonym Max Brand. His real name, Frederick Schiller Faust, was not particularly convenient in 1917. I presume that the inconvenience the writer alludes to here arose from the fact that the U.S. was at war with Germany at the time. The name Max Brand, however, was wonderfully suited for popular stories, especially Westerns. Faust published his fiction under a variety of other pen names as well. The Claws of the Tigress originally appeared under the name George Challis, which Faust and his agents preferred for his historical adventure pieces. A few stories, including two published in Harper's in 1934, were published under Faust's own name. He also wrote and published poetry, his preferred form of literature, generally as Frederick Faust. Max Brand, pen name and public cover, has shielded Frederick Faust's life from close observation. Born in Seattle in 1892, he grew up poor and desperate in California's San Joaquin Valley. I grew up tall, gangling, crushed with shame because of dodged bills at local stores, he once told his daughter. Learning to withdraw from children of my age, thrown utterly into a world of books and daydreaming, daydreaming, daydreaming. By the time he reached 13, both his parents had died. At age 19, he worked his way into the University of California at Berkeley, where he discovered a talent for writing, turning out an amazing quantity of poems, essays, and plays. As a student, he also learned to drink heavily and resist authority. In 1915, partly because he criticized the president of the university in print, the Berkeley faculty refused to grant him his degree. He then spent several hectic years trying to enlist in the Great War and establish himself as a poet at the same time. He failed at both efforts, but, in New York City, he learned that he could produce popular stories for pulp magazines like All Story Weekly, Argosy, Detective Story Magazine, and Western Story Magazine. In 1917, he married his college sweetheart in California, moved with her to New York, and continued his pulp writing. While he wanted fame as a poet, his success came in the millions of words he produced for the pulps, especially in the form of Western stories. In the early 1920s, though no more than 30 years old, he suffered a heart attack. His self-imposed cure was to work harder and live faster. In 1926, he moved to Italy with his growing family, living for the next 12 years in a rented villa in Florence. His prose often earned him over $70,000 a year. By the way, that is well over $1 million today. During those years, he turned out an average of over 3,000 words of saleable fiction daily. He would work all morning to write three lines of poetry, and all afternoon to produce 25 pages of his latest story. In 1918, shortly after the beginning of his career as a writer for Frank A. Munsey's pulp magazines, especially All Story Weekly and Argosy, he complained to a friend about the difficulty of writing serials. The serial writer, he explained, had to drag in new characters and complications and use 1,000 tricks to make the narrative long enough for the typical 5 to 8 installments in a magazine. But short stories were different. After all, they're rather fun to write, he said. No padding was required. All you have to do is concentrate on a snappy beginning and a smash for the close. In reality, Faust was a writer of enormous and diverse talent. He was also a writer tormented deeply by his own genius and ambitions, and generally unable to appreciate his own ability to write prose fiction. Perhaps because of these demons, he spent every dollar he earned, and more, on his lavish style of life. He was more than generous with friends, relatives, and struggling writers in need. Often, he drank heavily. After 1932, when pulp magazines began to fail, Faust turned to other magazine markets and eventually to Hollywood. Between 1938 and 1944, he worked as a screenwriter for MGM, Columbia, and Warner Brothers, and formed close associations with Thomas Mann, Aldous Huxley, Richard Aldington, and other writers lured to Hollywood. In 1942, Warner Brothers teamed him with William Faulkner to collaborate on the screenplay for The De Gaulle Story. He continued to publish stories and novels, yet he was never satisfied with his accomplishments, and claimed to be embarrassed in particular by his popular fiction. He yearned to write poetry on the scale and in the style of the classic Europeans he admired. Homer, Dante, Chaucer, and Shakespeare. He felt unsatisfied, incomplete, unable to direct himself toward true literary achievement. The inside story of his life, he said in 1939, was one of aspiration gone wrong. He was anxious to make more money than the $1,000 per week the Hollywood studios were paying him, though earning the money in that manner made him feel like he had sold his artistic soul. The writer who had missed the action in an earlier war wanted to report the experiences of American infantrymen in World War II. To that end, Faust convinced Harper's to make him a war correspondent. With a bad heart, almost 52 years old, he was assigned to the 5th Army in Italy, not far from his old villa in Florence, shortly before the beginning of a major Allied offensive on May 11, 1944. Within a few hours after the fighting started that night, he was killed by a shell fragment. Throughout his complicated personal life, Faust hid from public view his role as a writer of fiction. No one, certainly not Faust himself, revealed the true identity of Max Brand until 1938, when one of his book publishers wrote about him in a Publisher's Weekly article. The combination of intentional anonymity and multiple pen names have always made it difficult to describe and assess Faust's place in American literature. He's familiar to many readers today only as the writer of Western novels that since the mid-1940s have filled the paperback book racks in drugstores, bus depots, and convenience stores, places where American readers have sought the entertainment of novels. His stature in the eyes of the general public is similar to that of Zane Grey or Louis L'Amour. As a result, when critics and scholars have written about Faust, they have stressed his role within the rise of the popular Western. The reputation of Max Brand as a writer of Westerns certainly has less to do with Faust's publicity efforts, which were minimal, than with the great resurgence of interest in Westerns after World War II. He left behind almost 200 Western novels, virtually all of which had been originally published in pulp magazines between 1918 and 1938. Faust died at the beginning of the paperback era, which delivered his work to a new generation of readers. As a result, he's been over-recognized as a writer of Westerns. Brand's life, full of dramatic intensity and psychological conflict, deserves attention in and of itself. But his stories, particularly his short stories, stand out as small monuments of achievement in a literary career that was overwhelmed by an enormous number of published works. Faust's talents in other areas of fiction have gone unnoticed, except by a faithful, but generally uncritical, following of fans and collectors. Ironically, the sheer quantity of fiction Faust produced has given critics reason to neglect him or to see his work as the product of outside forces, rather than true creativity. After all, he published over 900 volumes of fiction in his lifetime. William F. Nolan, author of Max Brand, Western Giant, published in 1986, a biographical checklist, points out that during a mere 3 years in the early 1930s, Faust published more than 5 million words, or the equivalent of 75 novels. Faced with such numbers, recent scholars have tended to sort through presumably representative texts, mainly Westerns, in search of evidence to support a single theme. Often that theme is a hypothesis concerning the importance of external influences on Faust's life. Christine Bold, for instance, wrote of Faust's divided allegiance between money and art, a division evident in his two literary roles, commercial writer and classical poet. The internal struggle within Faust thus informs the narrative technique of his Westerns. The split between Faust and Brand, between classicist and hack, which Faust assumed was completely absent from his stories, actually gives his novels a distinctive dimension, Bold stated. Cynthia Hamilton claims deep psychological origins for many features of Max Brand, especially the kind of underdog hero his Westerns often incorporate into intensely personal myths that are relevant to those on the bottom of the socioeconomic heap. In Hamilton's view, such traits in Brand's Westerns derive from Faust's own childhood, especially from, quote, ambiguous feelings about his father, end quote. Such approaches to Faust's fiction, from outside in, so to speak, and with emphasis on his Westerns, are provocative and illuminating, but they tend to give greater credence to the effects of external forces than to Faust's own superior powers as a writer. Moreover, the focus on a single apparent theme, as evidenced by Max Brand Westerns, shortchanges the diverse reality of Faust's fiction. He wrote in many genres, and his works express a variety of themes. Gore Vidal once said that it is the peculiar fate of American writers not to achieve fame, but to become celebrities. In the case of Max Brand, however, the opposite is true. Max Brand was famous, but Frederick Faust was never a celebrity. In fact, the writer who made the name famous, Frederick Schiller Faust, took rigorous measures to protect himself from public view. Even to his own children, he told elaborate stories to conceal his writing of magazine fiction. By 1937, when Paramount released the first Dr. Kildare movie, Interns Can't Take Money, starring Joel McRae and Barbara Stanwyck, some people knew that Faust was Brand. But this knowledge, even when spread by Publishers Weekly the next year, did little to disrupt the security that Faust had created for himself. The greatest irony of his career is the stark contrast between the popularity of Max Brand and the privacy of Frederick Faust. The stories in this book, which honors the centennial of Faust's birth, will certainly help readers understand both the popular appeal of Max Brand and the broad, complex talent of Brand's creator. And again, that was by William Bloodworth. And I'll begin our story with a quote from another critic cited in the book. In his first Western tale, Above the Law, Faust's villain, the bandit Jim Black, has the books of Scott, Shakespeare, Poe, Byron, and Mallory at his bunk. Poetic passages are found in practically every Faust story. These unexpected and to action addicts may be unwelcome interludes are Faust's invitation to walk the long distance into the minds of one another, as he states in Evan Evans' Montana Rides, where his triumphant hero proclaims, "I feel as if I owned the whole green world." And that was from Ray Meador in Frederick Faust, Pulp Writer and Poet, published in Book Source magazine in July 2005. And now here is Above the Law by Max Brand. Chapter 1, $2,000 Reward. Her eyes were like the sky on a summer night, a color to be dreamed of, but never reproduced. From the golden hair to the delicate hands which cupped her chin, a flower-like loveliness kept her aloof from her surroundings, like a rare pearl set in base metal. Her companion, young and darkly handsome, crumpled in a hand scarcely less white than hers, the check which the waiter had left. In the meantime, he gazed with some concern at his companion. Her lips stirred, and she sighed. "$2 for ham," she murmured. "Can you beat it, Freddy?"
"He sort of sagged when we slipped him the order," answered the dark and distinguished youth.
"I guess the hens are only making one-night stands in this country."
"They've got an audience anyway," she returned, "and that's more than we could draw."
She opened her purse and passed two bills to him under the table. "Why the camouflage?" he asked as he took the money. "Freddy," she said, "run your glass eye over the men in this joint. If they see you pay for the eats with my money, they take you for a skirt in disguise." A light twinkled for an instant far back in her eyes.
"Take me for a skirt," said Frederick Montgomery, in his most austere manner. "Say, cutie, lay off on the rough stuff and get human. The trouble with you, La Belle Geraldine, is that you forget your real name is Annie Kerrigan."
Her lazy smile caressed him. "Freddy," she purred, "you do your dignity bit, the way Charlie Chaplin would do Hamlet." Mr. Montgomery scowled upon her, but the dollar bills in the palm of his hand changed the trend of his thoughts at once.
"Think of it, Jerry," he groaned. "If we hadn't listened to that Piker Delaney, we'd be doing small big time over the R&W.
"Take it easy, dearie," answered La Belle Geraldine. "I've still got 100 iron men, but that isn't enough to take both of us to civilization." Montgomery cleared his throat, frowned, and raised his head like a patriot making a death speech in the third act.
"Geraldine," he said solemnly, "it ain't right for me to sponge on you now. You take the money. It'll get you back to Broadway. As for me, I can go work in one of those mines with these ruffians."
La Belle Geraldine chuckled. "You couldn't do it without makeup, Freddy. And besides, think of spoiling those hands with a pick handle." Mr. Montgomery regarded his tender palms with a rather sad complacency.
"There's no other way out, Jerry. Besides, I can.
His voice trailed away drearily, and La Belle Geraldine regarded him with the familiar twinkle far back in her eyes. "You're a born hero, Freddy, on the stage. But we're minus electric lights out here, and the play's no good."
"We're minus everything," declared Freddy with heat, overlooking the latter part of her speech. "This joint hasn't even got a newspaper in it, unless you call this rag one."
He pulled out a crumpled paper, a single sheet poorly printed on both sides. Geraldine took it and regarded it with languid interest. "The funny thing," she muttered as she read, "is that I sort of like this rube gang out here, Freddy."
"Like them?" snorted her companion, as he shook down his cuffs and tightened his necktie. "Say, Jerry, you're talking in your sleep. Wake up. Get next to yourself. Pipe the guy in the corner piling fried potatoes on his knife with a chunk of bread."
She turned her head. "Kinda neat action, all right," she said critically. "That takes real courage, Freddy. If his hand slipped, he'd cut his throat. Don't be so sore on them.
As parlor snakes, they ain't in your class, but don't spend all your time looking at the stage set. Watch the show and forget the background, Freddy. These boys may eat with knives and get a little too familiar with their revolvers, but they strike me as being 100% men. You always were a nut, Jerry, yawned Montgomery. For my part, give me the still small voice, but not the wilderness. I can see all the rough nature I want in the Central Park Zoo. He pushed back his chair. Wait a minute, Freddy. Hold the curtain while I play the overture. I've got an idea. Listen to this. She spread out the Snyder Gulch clarion and read, Attention, men of Snyder Gulch, it's up to us. The citizens of Three Rivers have organized to rid the mountains of Black Jim. Prominent miners of that town have placed $2,000 on deposit and offered it for the capture of the bandit, dead or alive. Men, is Snyder Gulch going to be left behind by a jerkwater shanty village like Three Rivers? No. Let's get together. If Three Rivers can offer $2,000 for the capture of Black Jim, Snyder Gulch can offer $3,000 easy. We've got to show Three Rivers that we're on the map. How's that for a line of talk, Freddy? What's the point? He queried. What do you get out of that monologue? Wait a minute. The drums are still going out in the orchestra, and your cue hasn't come yet. But before I get through, I'm going to ring up the curtain on a three-act melodrama that'll fill up the house and give the box office insomnia. She went on with the reading. We can't expect to land Black Jim in a hurry. The reward money will probably get covered with cobwebs before it's claimed. The men who get it will have their hands full, that's certain. If they can even find his hiding place, they will be doing their share of work. There are a number of theories about the way he works. Some people think that he lives either in Snyder Gulch or Three Rivers and does his hold-ups on the side. No man has ever seen his face because of the black mask he wears over his eyes. All we know is that his hair is black and that he always rides a roan horse. But that ought to be enough to identify him. Some hold that he hides in some gulch with a lot of other outlaws. They don't think he leads a gang, because he always works alone. But they believe that other gunmen have found his hiding place and are living near him. If that's the case, and Black Jim can be found in his home, we will clean out the bandits who have given our town a black name. If Black Jim is caught, he will surely hang. He hasn't killed anyone yet, but he's wounded 9 or 10, and if he's ever pressed hard, there's sure to be a lot of bloodshed. However, it's up to the brave men of Snyder Gulch to take the chance. If they get him, they'll probably get the rest of the gunfighters who've been sticking up stages, which is Black Jim's specialty, and robbing and killing lone miners and prospectors, which is the long suit of the rest of the crowd. In conclusion, all we have to say is that the man who gets the money for Black Jim's capture will earn it, and our respect along with it. She dropped the paper. Now do you see, Freddy? I'm no psychic wonder, Jerry, he answered with some irritation. How can I tell what act you're thinking of? Wait a minute. He gaped at her with sudden astonishment. Say, Jerry, he growled, have you got a hunch that I'm going to go out and catch this man-eating Black Jim? She broke into musical laughter. Freddy, she said, when she could speak again, I'd as soon send you to capture the bandit as I'd send a baby with a paper knife to capture a machine gun. No, dearie, I know you want to get out of here, but I don't want you to start east in a coffin. It costs too much. Slip it to me easy, Jerry, he said, or I'll get peeved. Don't make me nervous, she mocked. I don't ask you to do anything rough except to put on clothes like the ones these fellows around here are wearing. Heavy boots, overalls, broad-brimmed hat, red bandana around the neck. He stared at her without comprehension. Do you think they'll pay to see me in an outfit like that? They ought to, and it's my idea to make them. It's a nice little bit for us both, Freddy. First act starts like this. Stage set. A western mining town. Three rivers. Enter the lead. A girl. Stunning. Blonde. Wears corduroy walking skirt. Montgomery grinned, but still looked baffled. You hate yourself, all right, he said. But lead on the action. Nobody knows why the girl is there, and nobody cares, because they don't ask questions in a mining town.
Not even about the theater, groaned Montgomery.
Shut up, Freddy, cut in La Belle Geraldine. You spoiled the scene with your monologue stunts. I say, the swell blonde appears and buys a seat on the stage, which starts that afternoon, running towards Truckee. She kids the driver along a little, and he lets her sit on the seat beside him. As soon as she gets planted there, she begins to talk. Let me see. Yes. She begins to hand out a swift line of chatter about what she can do with a revolver. Then she shows him a little nickel-plated revolver which she carries with her. He asks her to show off her skill, but she says, Nothing stirring, Oscar. Finally, they go round a curve, and out rides a masked bandit on a roan horse. Everybody on the stage holds up their arms as soon as he comes out with his gun leveled.
How do you know they would do that? Said Montgomery.
Because they always do, answered Geraldine. Nobody thinks of making a fight when a masked man on a roan horse appears, because they know it's Black Jim, who can shoot the core out of an apple at 500 yards, or something like that. Well, they all hold up their hands, except the girl, who raises her revolver and fires, and though she used a blank cartridge, the gun jumps out of the grip of the bandit as if a bullet hit it. Then he holds up his hands, and everybody in the stage cheers, and the girl takes the bandit prisoner. The stage turns around and carries them back to Three Rivers. The people of the town come to look at Black Jim,
and they see I'm not the guy they want. Then the game's blown.
Not a hope, said Jerry. They don't know anything about this man-killer, except the color of his horse. They'll take you for granted.
Sure, groaned Montgomery. And hang me to the nearest tree, what?
Take it easy, Freddy. There's some law around here. You just keep your face shut after they take you. They'll wait to try it the next day, anyway. That'll give me time to cash in the reward. I'll be 50 miles east before they get wise. The next morning, when they come in to stick a rope on your neck, you simply light a cigarette and tell them it's all a mistake. Let them go to Snyder Gulch to the hotel, and they can find 100 people to recognize you as a ham actor. Tell them you were merely trying a little act of your own when you stuck up the stage, and that your partner flashed the gun from the driver's seat.
Say, kid,
the people of Three Rivers will see the laugh is on them, and they'll buy you a ticket to Denver just to get rid of you. I'll meet you there, and then we'll trot on to Broadway. Savvy? It's like a dream.
A nightmare, growled Montgomery, though light entered his face. But still...
What?
Jerry, I begin to think it wouldn't be such a hard thing to get away with this. But what if you couldn't get me out of the town? What if they started to lynch me without waiting for the law?
That's easy, smiled Geraldine. Then I step out and tell them it's simply one grand joke. All we would have to be sorry about is the money we spent on your horse and the clothes and the gun. It's a chance, Freddy, but it's a chance that's worth taking. There's a $2,000 reward. Montgomery's eyes hardened.
Jerry, he whispered, every stage that leaves Three Rivers has a lot of pure gold in the boot. Why not play the bandit part legitimate and grab the gold? It's a lot simpler, and there's no more risk.
Geraldine studied him curiously. You've got the makings of a fine crook, Freddy. It's in your eye now. He colored and glanced away. It's no go, dearie. If we cheat these miners with my little game, at least we know that the money comes only from the rich birds who can afford to put up a reward. But if we grab the cash in the boot, how can we tell we aren't taking the bread and jam out of the mouth of some poor pick swinger with a family to support? She finished with a smile, but there was a suggestion of hardness in her voice.
Jerry,
he answered. You're certainly fast in the beam. I'd go a 10-spot to a Canadian dime that you could make up with one hand and darn stockings with the other. We'll do it your way if you wish. It'll be a great show. Right you are, Freddy. You've got the face for the act. They had to spend $100 for a horse, a revolver, and Montgomery's clothes. He spent most of the day shopping and at night came home with the necessary roan, a tall animal which was cheapened by bad ring bones. His clothes, except the hat and boots, were very inexpensive, and he managed to buy a second-hand revolver for $6. While he made these purchases, La Belle Geraldine, now registered at the hotel as Annie Kerrigan, opened a conversation with the girl who worked in the store. She proved diffident at first, with an envious eye upon Jerry's hat with its jaunty feather curled along the side. But in the end, La Belle's smile thawed the cold. She handed me the frosty eye, reported Jerry to Montgomery that evening, until I put her wise on some millinery stunts. After that, it was easy. She told me all she knew about Black Jim, and a lot more. People say he's a big chap. So are you, Freddy. His complexion is dark. So is yours. One queer thing is that he has never killed anyone. The paper said that, and the girl said it too. It seems he's a big-time guy with a gun, and when he shoots, he can pick a man in the arm or the leg just as he pleases. I don't suppose you can hit a house at 10 yards, Freddy, but it's a cinch they aren't going to try you out with a revolver. Not as long as they have a hunch that you're Black Jim. That night, Montgomery learned all that he could be told about the stage route and the time it left Three Rivers. By dawn of the next day, he and Jerry were on the road toward Three Rivers by different routes. Chapter 2. Hands Up. The happiness of women, say the moralists, depends upon their ability to preserve illusions. Annie Kerrigan punched so many holes in that rule that she made it look like a colander. Illusions and gloom filled her earlier girlhood in her little Illinois hometown. Those illusions chiefly concerned men. They made the masculine sex appear vast in strength and illimitable in mystery. She remembered saying to a youth who wore a white flower in his lapel and parted his hair in the middle and curled it on the sides, "When I talk to you, I feel as if I were poking at a man in armor. I never find the real you. What is it?" The youth occupied 2 hours in telling her about the real you. He was so excited that he held her hand as he proceeded in the revelation. When he left, she boiled down everything he had said. It was chiefly air, and all that wasn't air was surrounded with quotation marks so large that even Annie Kerrigan could see them. So she revised her opinion of men a little. In place of part of the question marks, she substituted quotations. As she grew older and prettier, she learned more. In fact, she learned a good deal more than she wished to know about every attractive youth in her town. So Annie Kerrigan started out to conquer new worlds of knowledge. Her family balked, but Annie was firm. She went to Chicago, where she found the stockyards and more men. They smiled at her in the streets. They stared at her in restaurants. They accosted her at corners. So the mystery wore off. About this time, Annie was left alone in the world to support herself. She starved for 6 months in a department store. Then an enterprising theatrical manager offered her a chance in a third-rate vaudeville circuit. Before that season ended, she had completed her definition of men. In her eyes, they were one half quotation marks and the other half bluff. Every one of them had his pet mystery in secret. Annie Kerrigan found that if she could get them to tell her that secret, they forged their own chains of slavery and gave her the key to the lock. In time, she held enough keys to open the doors of a whole city full of masculine souls. But she never used those keys because, as she often said to herself, she wasn't interested in interior decoration. The exceptions were when she wanted a raise in salary or a pleasure excursion. In this manner, Annie Kerrigan of many illusions and more woes developed into La Belle Geraldine, with no illusions, a light heart, and a conscience that defied insomnia. She loved no one in particular, not even herself, but she found the world a tolerably comfortable place. To be sure, it was not a dream world. La Belle Geraldine was so practical that she knew cigarettes stained the fingers yellow and increased the pulse. She even learned that orange Pekoe tea is pleasanter than cocktails, and that men are more often foolish than villainous. Without illusions, the mental courage of Jerry equaled that of a man. Therefore, she commenced this adventure without fear or doubt of the result. It was a long journey, but her lithe, strong body, never weakened by excess, never grown heavy with idleness, shook off the fatigue of the labor as a coyote that has traveled all day and all night shakes off its weariness and trots on, pointing its keen nose against the wind. So she went on, sometimes humming an air, sometimes pausing an instant to look across the valley at the burly peaks, and far beyond these, range after range of purple-clad monsters, like a great hierarchy whose heads rise closer and closer to heaven itself. She found herself smiling in spite of herself, and for no cause whatsoever. She'd estimated the distance to Three Rivers at about 10 miles, yet it seemed to her that she'd covered scarcely a third of that space when the road twisted down and she was in the village. It was even smaller than Snyder Gulch. The type of man to which she had grown accustomed during the past few weeks swarmed the street. They paid little attention to her, even as she had expected. Mountains discourage personal curiosity. The 6 horses were already hitched to the stage, and baggage was piled in the boot. After she bought a passage to Truckee, her money was exhausted. If she failed, the prospect was black indeed. She could not even telegraph for help, particularly since there was not a telegraph line within 2 days' journey. She shrugged this thought away as unworthy. When the passengers climbed up to select their seats, Geraldine remained on the ground to talk with the driver about his near leader, a long-barreled bay with a ragged mane and a wicked eye. The driver, as he went from horse to horse, examining tugs and other vital parts of the harness, informed her that the bay was the best mountain horse he had ever driven, and that with this team he could make 2 hours better time than on any of the other relays between Three Rivers and Truckee. She showed such smiling interest in this explanation that he asked her to sit up on his seat while he detailed the other points of interest about his team. Her heart quickened. The first point in the game was won. As they swung out into the shadowed road, for the canyons were already half dark, though it was barely sunset, she made a careful inventory of the passengers. There were 9 besides herself, and all were men. 2 of them, sitting just behind the driver, held sawed-off shotguns across their knees and stared with frowning sagacity into the trees on either side of the road, as if they already feared an attack. Their tense expectancy satisfied La Belle Geraldine that the first appearance of her bandit would take the fight out of them. The others were mostly young fellows who hailed each other in loud voices and broke into an immediate exchange of mining gossip. She feared nothing from any of these. The driver worried her more. To be sure, his only weapon was a rifle which lay along the seat just behind him, with its muzzle pointing out to the side, a clumsy position for rapid work. But his lean face with the small, sad eye made her guess at qualities of quiet fearlessness. However, it was useless to speculate on the chances for or against Montgomery. The event could be scarcely more than 30 minutes away. They had scarcely left 3 bridges behind when she produced the small revolver from her pocket. The driver grinned and asked if it were loaded. It was a sufficient opening for Geraldine. she sketched briefly for his benefit a life in the wilds during which she had been brought up with a rifle in one hand and a revolver in the other. The stage drive heard her with grim amusement while she detailed her skill in knocking squirrels out of a treetop. "The top of a tree like that one, lady?" he asked, pointing out a great sugar pine. "You don't believe me?" asked Jerry, with a convincing assumption of pique. "I wish there was a chance for me to show you." "Hmm," said the driver. "There's a tolerable lot of things for you to aim at along the road. Take a whirl at anything you want to. The horses won't bolt when they hear the gun." "If I did hit it," said Jerry, with truly feminine logic, "you would think it was luck." She dropped the pistol back into the pocket of her dress. They were swinging round a curve which brought them to the foot of the long slope, at the top of which Montgomery must be waiting. "I hope something happens," she assured the driver, "and then I'll show you real shooting." "Maybe," he nodded. "I've lived so long, nothing surprises me, lady." She smiled into the fast-growing night and made no answer. Then she broke out into idle chatter again, asking the names of all of the horses and a thousand other questions, for a childish fear came to her that he might hear the beating of her heart and learn its meaning. Up they drudged on the long slope, the harness creaking rhythmically as the horses leaned into the collars, and the traces stiff and quivering with the violence of the pull. The driver, with his reins gathered in one hand and the long whip poised in the other, flicked the laggards with the lash. "Look at them lug all together as if they were trying to keep time," he said to Geraldine. "I call that a team. But this grade here keeps them winded for half an hour after we hit the top." The rank odor of the sweating horses rose to her. A silence, as if their imaginations labored with the team, fell upon the passengers. Even Geraldine found herself leaning forward in the seat, as though this would lessen the load.
"Yo-ho, boys!" shouted the driver. "Get into that collar, Dixie, you wall-eyed excuse for a hoss! Yeah, queen, good girl!"
His whip snapped and hummed through the air.
"One more lug altogether, and we're there."
They lurched up onto the level ground, and the horses, still leaning forward to the strain of the pole, stumbled into a feeble trot. Jerry sat a little sidewise in the seat, so that from the corner of her eye she could watch the rest of the passengers. One of the guards was lighting a cigarette for the other.
"Hands up!" called a voice.
The driver cursed softly, and his arms went slowly into the air. The hands of the two guards shot up even more rapidly. Not 3 yards from the halted leaders, a masked man sat on a roan horse, reined across the road, and covered the stage with his revolver.
"Keep those hands up," ordered the bandit. "Now get out of that stage, and don't get your hands down while you're doing it. You, all there by the driver, get up your hands damn quick."
Chapter 3. The Mixed Cast. A great tide of mirth swelled in Jerry's throat. She recognized in these deep and ringing tones the stage voice of Freddie Montgomery. Truly, he played his part well. She crouched a little toward the stage driver, whipped out the revolver, and fired. But a louder explosion blended with the very sound of her shot. The revolver spun out of her fingers, and exquisite pain burned her hand. Her rage kept her from screaming. She groaned between her set teeth. This was an ill day for Frederick Montgomery.
"For God's sakes," breathed a voice from the stage behind her, "he'll kill all of us now. It's Black Jim."
"Down to the road with you," cried the bandit, in the same deep voice. "And the next of you all that tries a fancy trick, I'll drill you clean." Warm blood poured out over her hands, and the pain set her shuddering, but the white-hot fury gave her strength. Jerry was the first to touch the ground.
"You fool," she moaned. "You big, clumsy, square-headed, bat-eyed fool! They'll stick you in the pen for life for this."
"Shut up,"
advised a cautious voice from the stage, where the passengers stood bolt upright, willing enough to descend, but each afraid to move.
"Shut up, or you'll have him murdering us all."
"Sorry, lady," said the masked man, and still he maintained that heavy voice. "If I had seen you was a girl, I wouldn't have fired."
"Oh, tell that to the judge," cried Geraldine. "You shot my hand off. I'll bleed to death, and you'll hang for it. I tell you, you'll hang for it."
He'd reined his horse from his position in front of the leaders, and now he swung from his saddle to the ground, a sudden motion during which he kept his revolver steadily leveled.
"Steady in there," he ordered, "and get the hell out of that stage or I'll blow you out."
He gestured with his free hand to Jerry.
"Tear off a strip from your skirt and tie that hand up as tight as you can. Here, one of you, get down here and help the lady. You can take your hands down to do that."
But there was another thought than that of La Belle Geraldine in the mind of the practical stage driver. His leaders stood now without obstruction. He had lost one passenger, indeed, but the gold in the boot of his stage was worth 100 passengers to him. He shouted a warning, dropped flat on his seat, and darted his whip out over the horses. At his call, the other passengers groveled flat, which put the thickness of the boot between them and the bullets of the bandit. The horses hit the collars, and the stage whirled into the dusk of the evening. To pursue them was folly, for it would be a running fight with two deadly shotguns, handled by men concealed and protected. The masked man fired a shot over the heads of the fugitives and turned on Jerry. She was weak with excitement and loss of blood, and even her furious anger could not give her strength for long. She staggered.
"I'm done for, all right," she gasped. "As a bandit, you're the biggest cheese ever. My hand. Blood. Help."
Red Knight swam before Jerry's eyes, and as utter dark came, she felt an arm pass round her. When she woke from the swoon, her entire right arm ached grimly. She was being carried on horseback up a steep mountainside. The trees rose sheer above her. She strove to speak, but the intolerable weakness flooded back on her, and she fainted again. She recovered again in less pain, lying in a low-roofed room, propped up on blankets. A lantern hung against the wall from a nail, and by its light she made out the form of the man who stooped over her and poured steaming hot water over her hand. He still wore the mask. She closed her eyes again and lay gathering her wrath, her energy, and her vocabulary for the supreme effort which confronted her.
"So you did your little bandit bit, did you?"
she said at last, with keen irony, as she opened her eyes again.
"You had to pull the grandstand stunt with a fine audience at 10 to watch you. You had to..."
"Lie still. Don't talk," he commanded, still in that deep and melodramatic bass which enraged her. "You have a fever, kind of. It ain't much. Just keep quiet and you'll be all right." It was the crowning touch. He was still playing his part.
"Dearie," she said fiercely, "this is the first time in my life I ever wished I was Shakespeare. Nobody but the old boy himself could do you justice. But I'm not Billy S., and I can only hint around some sort of vague at what I think of you. But of all the tin-horn sports, the ham-fat, small-time actors, you're the prize bonehead. Honey, does that begin to percolate? Does that begin to get through the armor plate down to that dwarf bean you're in the habit of calling your brain?"
He went on calmly pouring the hot water over her hand. She had not credited him with that much self-control. He did not even blush as far as she could make out. It made her throat dry with impotence.
"An old woman's home. That's where you belong," she went on. "Say, you're wise to keep that mask on. You'd need a disguise to get by as a property man on small time. Dearie, you haven't got enough bean to be number two man in a monologue."
He stared at her a moment, and then went on with the work of cleansing the bullet wound in her hand. Evidently, he did not trust himself to speak. It was not a severe cut, but it had bled freely, the bullet cutting the fleshy part between the thumb and the forefinger. To look at it made her head reel. She lay back on the pile of blankets and closed her eyes. When she opened them again, he was approaching with a small bottle half full of brownish-black fluid, iodine. She started, for she knew the burn of the antiseptic. She tucked her wounded hand under her other arm and glared at him. "Nothing doing with that stuff, cutie," she said, shaking her head. "This isn't my first season, even if I'm not on the big time. You can give that bottle to the Marines. Go pour that on the daisies, Alexander W. Flathead. He'll kill the insects, but not for mine." She saw his forehead pucker into a frown above the mask. He stopped, hesitated. "Take it away and rock it to sleep, Oscar," she went on, "because there's no cue for that in this act. It won't get across, not even with makeup. Oh, this'll make a lovely story when I get back to Broadway. I'm going to spill the beans, dearie. Yep, I'm going to give this spiel to the papers. It'll make a great ad for you, all scareheads. You can run the last musical comedy scandal onto the back page with a play like this. Here, let go of my arm, you big simp. Do you think..." He caught her wrist and drew out the injured hand firmly. She struggled weakly, but the pain in the hand unnerved her. "Go ahead. Turn on the fireworks, Napoleon. Honey, they'll write this on your tombstone for an epitaph." He spread her thumb and forefinger apart, poured some of the iodine onto a clean rag, and swabbed out the wound. The burning pain brought her close to a faint, but her fury kept her mind from oblivion. She clenched her teeth so that a tortured scream became merely a moan. When she recovered, he was making the last turn of a rather skillful bandage. She sat up on the blankets. "All right, honey, now you've played the music, and I'll dance. What's the way to town from here?" He shook his head. "Won't tell me, eh? I suppose you think I'll stay up here till I get well. Think again, janitor." She rose and started a bit unsteadily to the door. Before she reached it, his step caught up with her. She was swung up in strong arms and carried back to the blankets. While she sat dumb with hate and rage, he took a piece of rope and tied her ankles fast with an intricate knot, which she could never hope to untie with her one sound hand. "You'll stay here," he explained curtly. "Listen, dearie," she answered between her teeth, "I'm going to do you for this. I'm going to make you a bum draw on every circuit in the little old U.S. I'm going to make you the card that doesn't fill the straight, that's all. Get your shingle ready, cutie, because after this, all you can get across will be a chop house in the Bowery." "Lie still," growled the deep voice. "There ain't any chance of you getting away. Savvy?" He turned. "Dearie," she cried after him, "if you don't cut out that ghost voice stunt, I'll..." The rickety door at the back of the shack closed upon him. "I never knew," said Jerry to herself, "that that big Swede could do such a swell mystery bit. He ought to be in the heavies, that's all." She settled herself back on the blankets again more comfortably. The last sting of the iodine died away and left a pleasant sense of warmth in her injured hand. Now she set about surveying her surroundings in detail. It was the most clumsily built house she had ever seen, made of rudely trimmed logs, so loosely set together that the night air whistled through a thousand chinks. Two boards placed upon sawhorses represented a table. A crazily constructed fireplace of large dimensions was the only means of heating the shack. Here and there, from pegs and nails driven into the wall, hung overalls, deeply wrinkled at the knees, heavy mackintoshes, and two large hats of broad brim. On the floor were several pairs of heavy shoes in various states of dilapidation. In the corner next to the hearth, the walls were garnished with a few pots and pans. On the table, she saw a heavy hunting knife. There were three doors. Perhaps one of them led to a second room. To know which it was of vital significance to her. If it was the door through which the masked man had disappeared, then he still was within hearing distance. If that were true, she could hardly succeed in reaching that knife upon the table unheard, for she would make a good deal of noise dragging herself across the floor to the table. She determined to make the experiment. If she could cut the bonds and escape, she made no doubt that she could find the road to Three Rivers again, and even to wander across the mountains at night with a wounded hand was better than to stay with this bungler. Moreover, there was something in his sustained acting which made her uneasy. She knew his code of morals was as limited as the law of the Medes and the Persians, and of an exactly opposite nature. On the stage, in the city, she had no fear of him. He was an interesting type, and his vices were things at which she could afford to shrug her shoulders. But in the wilderness of the Silent Mountains, even the least of men borrows a significance, and the meaning he gave her was wholly evil. She commenced hunching herself slowly and painfully across the floor toward the table. Half, three-quarters of the distance was covered. In another moment she could reach out and take the knife. A door creaked behind her. She turned. There he stood again, still masked and with his hands behind him. He started. His mouth gaped. She made another effort and caught up the knife. At least it was a measure of defense, even if it were too late for her to free herself. Thus concludes the first installment of Above the Law by Max Brand. And we shall continue reading this story next week. Thank you for joining us once again for Western Short Stories. This has been Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
An old cowboy went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, up flowing through the ragged sky, and up the cloudy draw. High air.